with whom we have to do. And the life of Jehoshaphat and King Ahab is a very good illustration of this point in the book of Hebrews. You know, in our community, it's difficult often to keep a correct balance between love and fear. And sometimes, reflecting the spirit of the age, we may go too far to the side of emphasizing love. And yet, they're really like the two parts of a pair of scissors. If we can get the correct blend of love and fear, we produce the reverence, that godly attribute that is pleasing in the sight of the Almighty. And I don't know what part of Scripture is more calculated to help a young person to understand the fear of the Lord than these marvelous accounts preserved for us in the Kings and the Chronicles. Now, we are, unfortunately, cutting into the history of Judah and Israel, and we must therefore pick up some of the antecedents in chapter 17. And if we turn back in the accounts here, we can see what takes place at the time Jehoshaphat assumes the throne. In fact, back in chapter 15, we have here, in chapter 14, we have here the work of King Asa. And King Asa, by and large, was a righteous king. And we read of his great exploits in verse 11 of chapter 14 of 2 Chronicles. And Asa cried to the Lord his God, O Lord, there is none like thee to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on thee, and in thy name we have come against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God, and let not man prevail against thee. So Asa is the chariot of Yahweh, and he rests in those unseen chariots of Yahweh, the angelic hosts that were strong on behalf of the nation. And so the king that we see here is a king of great faith at this stage in his life, resting on the great significance of the name, thy memorial name, the desire of our soul. Now in chapter 15, we are introduced to Azariah, the son of Oded, a prophet. And he went out to meet Asa and said to him, Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. Yahweh is with you, while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. Glorious words in the book of the Chronicles. And yet, brothers and sisters, it is so easy in our life of discipleship, in what we might call the me generation. The 70s have been viewed by men in education as being the me decade. To the teenager, and alas, many of the adults, I want it, and I want it now, and I can't wait. The me decade. And they expect God to work by miracle what he expects us to work by muscle. And here we have the basic premise of the Lord's dealing with men. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. And so the prophet's encouraged in verse 7. The king is encouraged. But you take courage, and do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded. And so Asa, this king in Judah, commences a religious revival in the nation. And we're introduced to these kings in a chronology that we have here painted by the young people. We have King Asa reigning here following the short reign of Abijah and, of course, the reign of Rehoboam. Now, contemporary with King Asa and very important in the narrative is the reign of Baasha, as we shall see in a minute, a wicked king, followed by the short reign of Elah and the evil reign of Omri. So this is the line of the king of Judah. This is the line of the kings of Israel. And over here we have the Gentile powers of the day, the expanding power of Assyria, and we shall see where Assyria comes into the narrative as well. And the prophets who minister at this time the prophet Hanani and the prophet Jehu, as you see here. Now, what happened was a migration of the more spiritually minded Jews from the kingdom of the north to the better spiritual climate in the south, as you can see in verse 9 of chapter 15. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin, and those from Ephraim and Manasseh and Simeon who were sojourning with them. For great numbers had deserted to him from Israel when they saw that the Lord his God was with him. Now, it's incidental but important here to note that the very prosperity that this king experienced in his religious work was to be the source of a trial that led to his downfall. And here he's able, at this stage of his life, to rally the nation in the south. In verse 15, all Judah rejoiced over the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart and had sought him with their whole desire, and he was found by them, speaking of Yahweh, and the Lord gave them rest about. So we have here, brothers and sisters, a king who is experiencing some of the great blessings, the successes in his religion. But all was not well. It says of Asa, verse 17, that the high places were not taken out of Israel, and nevertheless the heart of Asa was blameless all his days. And then his trial came. For in the 36th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might permit no one to go out or to come into Asa, king of Judah. Virtually, he closed the border between the kingdom in the north and the kingdom in the south. Now, as we've outlined, this was for good reasons as far as Baasha was concerned, because he was losing members of his kingdom who were deserting to this better spiritual climate in the south. So what did he do? He built this fortified city, Ramah, right on the border, and sealed the border. So the religious work that Asa had embarked on had within it the seeds of trial, unknown to him. The apparent success, the blessing of the Almighty upon the work, when they, with their whole heart, they sought the Lord and they had peace round about, was only temporary. Now, here's a trial for Asa, and what is he going to do? You see, God has blessed him with a period of apparent prosperity, peace from his enemies, and then comes the day of trial. And Asa, in verse 2, we read, took silver and gold from the treasures of the house of the Lord and the king's house, and sent them to Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus. Let there be a league between me and you, as between my father and your father. Now, what the king did was purchase political security. And we can see this perhaps a little clearer if we look at the geography of this period in the nation. Now, this is the area that we're speaking about. We have Asa reigning here in the kingdom of Judah in the south. Ramah is the defense city that Baasha builds here to try to stem the flow of people to the better spiritual climate in the south. All was well with the king, but then he saw trouble looming. So he went over here to Syria, way over here to Damascus. And he went to Damascus, he sent to Damascus and said, let there be a league between me and you, as between my father and your father. Behold, I am sending to you silver and gold, and go break your league with Baasha, king of Israel. And so what did the king do, Ben-Hadad? He attacked the cities in the north, Abel-Maacah, Ijon, and Dan in the north. And of course, when King Baasha saw the threat from Syria, then he took the pressure off the south. And so it appeared from this politically expedient move on the part of King Asa that he had indeed won the day. But what a price he had to pay. Here was a great illustration of a king who did evil that good might come. And if one were to look at the political scene of the day, it would appear this was a very successful move on the part of King Asa. His kingdom potentially was threatened in the south. A blocking, opposing the border had occurred at Ramah. A store city had been built there, and so he purchased security. But alas, it isn't true that a person, as they get older in life, always get wiser. And this king at the end of his life here, rather than resting on the name of the Lord on these unseen chariots in chapter 14, as he had done, he purchased political security from Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. And so in verse 7, at that time, Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, "Because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you." In verse 9, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show his might in behalf of those whose heart is blameless toward him." And he indicts the king. And this prophet, Hanani, comes to the king and he indicts him for what he's done, because he did not rest on those watchers of Daniel, those eyes of the Lord, those angels that were protecting the camp of Israel. "And you have done foolishly in this, for from now on you will have wars." Now, brothers and sisters, not only did Asa find a great test of his integrity in how he would handle the threat of Baasha, and he failed that test, he's faced right away with another test when apparently he had success. Humanly speaking, Asa had success. He no longer had a threat from Baasha. In fact, he broke down Ramah and he built two store cities himself, as we read here. And yet he's indicted by the prophet. And many of us who can stand with our God, so to speak, in the time of despair and difficulty, have a great time standing with our God in the period of prosperity and success. Look when David fell, at a time when kings go out to war. And where was David? At the height of his prosperity. When we look at King Hezekiah, he did not make return for all the benefit that the Lord had brought upon him. And the repeated pattern in the Kings and the Chronicles account is that the kings fell in time of prosperity and success. And so here's Asa, and now he's reproved by a prophet. Is he going to be malleable to the divine influence? After all, the prophet had said to him, "If you seek him, he will be found by you. If you forsake him, he will forsake you." What was the man going to do? Here was the test of his mettle. Was he going to lose face before all those in Judah after apparently succeeding in his political enterprise? No, the king fell. And we read what he did. "Then Asa was angry with the seer, and he put him in the stocks in prison, for he was in a rage with him because of this. And Asa inflicted cruelties upon some of the people at the same time." A great lesson, brothers and sisters, in human nature. Here is a king who, because of his pride, in the day of his own apparent personal success, is reproved spiritually, and he is not humbled under the hand of the Almighty. "And he took the prophet and he threw him in stocks and in prison, and was in a rage with the people, and inflicted cruelties upon them." And alas, the end of Asa is recorded for us, that he became diseased in his feet, verse 12, and his disease became severe, yet even in his disease he did not seek the Lord, but sought help from physicians. And Asa slept with his fathers. Now on the scene comes Jehoshaphat. Yahweh is judge. And we shall see, brothers and sisters, the effect of the political climate now upon him, and to see whether or not he will make the same mistakes as his father made. And so we're introduced into the life of Jehoshaphat, in that Jehoshaphat strengthened himself against Israel. His top priority was, in fact, to prevent further apostasy in the south. Now, remember, in the north, we have the great infiltration of
of Jezebel from Phoenicia, with all of that terrible religious apostasy set up in Samaria, and the country has apostatized almost as a whole in the north. And the first thing Jehoshaphat does is to strengthen himself against Israel. A wise policy indeed. And he placed forces in all the fortified cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. And the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the earlier ways of his father. Some translations like the AV give David, others Asa. He did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the ways of Israel. And therefore the Lord established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah brought tribute to Jehoshaphat, and he had great riches and honor, and his heart was courageous in the ways of the Lord. And furthermore, he took the high places and the Asherim out of Judah. So we're introduced to this very great reign of this king. And we go back now to look at the political situation around him. Hanani was the prophet ministering to Asa, whom, as we've seen, was thrown into prison by King Asa. King Asa dies, diseased in his feet, and presumably Jehoshaphat's reign overlaps the end of his reign. And along comes Jehoshaphat with his rather long reign in Judah. Meantime, the prophet Elijah is ministering principally in the north. The prophet Jehu is ministering in Judah, along with the prophet Micaiah that we've already read about. In the north, we have this extremely wicked house of Omri, with Ahab reigning contemporary with Jehoshaphat. As you can see here, their two reigns are together. And off to the far side here, we see Ben-Hadad of Syria. And of course, King Asa attempted to purchase security by a league with Ben-Hadad against King Baasha. And so in the political affairs of the day, we see the Phoenicians, the power of Tyre dominant, and the Syrians dominant, and the growing power of Assyria. And this is the political climate in which Jehoshaphat finds himself. And everything we read about here, brothers and sisters, indicates a king who has his priorities right. The first thing he does, stem apostasy. He can hardly promote a favorable climate of regeneration in the nation of Judah while the border is still open for apostasy to flow south. So Jehoshaphat seals the border, builds fortified cities, and then he proceeds to eradicate apostasy in the nation with a courageous heart in the ways of the Lord. And that's a beautiful phrase, courageous in the ways of the Lord. And that's the exact expression that the prophet Azariah had used of his father Asa. But you take courage, be courageous in the Lord, and do not let your hands be weak. Now, it's a common failing of a young person when they have, so to speak, all of the world at their doorstep, with all of the things that the world has to offer in the truth, employment, pleasure, and so on, that one very soon loses a sense of priorities. Not Jehoshaphat so far. By the third year of his reign, he recognizes that there was a tremendous educational job to be done in his kingdom. And so he selects the princes to give the authority of the crown to the work. And he lists there the men that went out. And they were to teach in the cities of Judah. And he sent with them the Levites. And with the Levites he sent the priests. And they taught among the people. It's a glorious time in Judah. A spiritual regeneration, almost like a Bible school in the whole nation of Judah. And the fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms of the lands that were round about Judah. Now that's important. You still had Philistines in the Shephelah. You still had the Moabites. You still had the hostile power of Syria. The hostile power of Assyria. So it wasn't that Jehoshaphat found himself in a vacuum, politically speaking. Rather, when a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him.
And Jehoshaphat experiences the fear of the Lord upon all the kingdoms of the Judah, and there is no war. And so the Philistines bring him presents. The Arabs bring him presents. And here again, in his apparent success, we have within this the seeds of what could be his downfall. Because it reads here that Jehoshaphat grew steadily greater, as did Asa, his father. And he built in Judah fortresses and store cities. And he had great stores in the cities of Judah. And the Authorized Version is very interesting in its rendering of this section. It says, Jehoshaphat had much business. And that term needs greatly underscoring. Much business. And Rotherham supports the Authorized Version in the rendering of that passage. Now here's the problem. We've got a king who sets about with right priorities. He sets about, first of all, to stop apostasy and then spiritual reform in the nation. He gives the authority of the princes to go out with the Levites and the priests to teach all the way through his kingdom. And then he becomes preoccupied with much business. And I'm sure many of the brethren are very sympathetic to Jehoshaphat at this point of his career. Because as brothers and sisters, a young man grows up in the world of his employment. As a Christadelphian, he no doubt has many characteristics that make him an excellent employee. And then there's the offer of promotion. And all the world seems like an oyster to him. And it can appear that promotion is success. And the very attributes or characteristics that have resulted in the employee being a person noted for progress through the organization can contain within it the seeds of his downfall. Because with more responsibility comes perhaps greater demands of time. And the brother who begins as an elementary school teacher may proceed up through the system and become then, in our language, a vice principal or a deputy headmaster, and then a headmaster. And he finds out that now he has night meetings to attend. And occasionally on Saturday he's called upon for duty. And he loses a week of his summer vacation to be with the school. And so all the prestige, all of the influence that goes with the apparent promotion and valued so highly by the world may well be a serious detriment, but unforeseen by the Christadelphian as he views his whole career, both in the truth and in the world. And brothers and sisters, the preoccupation of much business today in America is a problem of the women nearly as much as the men. Because the syndrome of the working wife in America is now almost as accepted in the Christadelphian community as it is in the world. And now the sisters attempt to pursue their careers within marriage. And needless to say, brothers and sisters, this has a most undesirable effect upon the family unit and life in the truth in America. The sister comes home too tired from the competition in the business world to make the dinner, look after the children, and then be at the Bible class. And so Bible class attendance becomes eroded. And when you're looking for Sunday school teachers, you can't find Sister X because she's just too tired and too preoccupied with the much business at home and at work. For what? For what advantage? More money? Of what value is that in the truth? And it eats out the heart and the marrow of the family life in the Christadelphian community. And we wonder where our young people are. And it begins, brothers and sisters, not when the teenager is a teenager, but when the teenager is a little child at home. And he misses the influence, the godly influence of a mother, because he's dropped off at a daycare center. And so the precious heritage that God has given us has been discharged to the Gentile. Jehoshaphat becomes preoccupied with much business. And so can we. And the apparent success of promotion, brothers and sisters, may have inherent within it the trial that we cannot stand in the truth. and he had great store cities, and he had soldiers, and he had mighty men of valor. And this was the muster of them by father's houses. And if you tally this total up, he's got an army of about 1 million men. Now, where's the trust then on the horses, the unseen chariots of the Almighty? Here's Jehoshaphat bristling with this huge army. Isn't that a temptation in itself? Just maybe to flex your military muscles. If you're sitting there with all this great army, maybe you're just itching for a chance to use them. Now Jehoshaphat, we read in chapter 18, verse 1, had great riches and honor. And he made a marriage alliance with Ahab. And there you see the fatal flaw in Jehoshaphat's makeup. Much like Asa. In his earlier time, his earlier period as a king, if you seek him, he will be found by you. And the nation goes out and they swear by an oath with all their heart and all their desire to seek the Lord. And then Asa falls because he goes up to Syria and purchases the support of Ben-Hadad against the king of Israel. And now Jehoshaphat, for whatever reasons, and we can't infer entirely what the reasons were here, whether he wanted to secure Ahab's support and relieve himself of any kind of threat from Ahab, or whether in fact he wanted to join or unite the whole of the kingdom, and he thought this would be the way to do it. At any rate, what we have here is a disastrous marriage alliance, as I'm sure you all know from your reading of what takes place. I'd like to show you just how disastrous this is, if we could maybe have that bank of lights out there. We have Asa, basically a good king, and his 41-year reign ended, as we know, with a state of war with Israel. Jehoshaphat comes on the scene, and he makes a marriage alliance with Ahab. Now, brothers and sisters, you must remember, this is not a father who's getting pressured by a son because he's found the girl up in Israel that he wants to marry. That's not the situation at all with Jehoshaphat. This is political expediency for whatever reason. It's like Solomon making affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, by taking Pharaoh's daughter. That was the way to secure yourself. And so here we find him securing apparent peace between the two kingdoms. Now, where did he go for the wife? Well, up in the north of the kingdom, we have Omri, of whom Scripture records that he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And furthermore, the relationship of Ahab and Jezebel, of them we read, there was none who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord like Ahab, whom Jezebel, his wife, incited. What a tragedy. And so what could you expect of the son? If he's got this kind of maternity on his side, of Jehoram we read, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife. You see, if we presume upon strength, this is what happens. Of what use was it for King Jehoshaphat to seal the border with the kingdom in the north? He seals the border by making fence cities and store cities there to prevent any kind of erosion of the kingdom in the south. And then he gives his son in marriage to the very household that had taken the kingdom in the north and brought it to its knees. But don't think, brothers and sisters, that inconsistency of character belongs only to King Jehoshaphat. I'm sure you can think in your own personal life of examples of that kind of foolish inconsistency in the truth, which but for the grace of God would brought us to the same circumstances as King Jehoram. And this wicked woman in the nation just about exterminated all of the seed royal, as you can see in 2 Kings chapter 11. Athaliah nearly destroyed all of the royal household. And where did it begin with? A political move on the part of Jehoshaphat. Whether to secure his kingdom or attempt to unite the two kings, it doesn't matter.
It was a foolish move on the king's part. And we shall see as we proceed here what happens. Now, it wasn't long before the marriage alliance is followed by a couple of others, as you can see here. And we're not going to have time to develop Jehoshaphat's relationship with all of the kings in Israel. But the marriage alliance was very soon followed by the military alliance, and then a commercial alliance, and then another military alliance. And we shall see, brothers and sisters, what takes place now in the relationship between King Jehoshaphat and King Ahab in the narrative. And we read of this now in 2 Kings chapter 18. He's made a marriage alliance. He's kind of sealed the relationship between the two kingdoms. And after some years, he went down to Ahab in Samaria. Boy, are those words full of meaning. He may have gone up to Samaria from Jerusalem, but spiritually, he went down to Ahab in Samaria. And well, Ahab made a great fanfare for him. And Ahab killed an abundance of sheep and oxen for him and for the people who were with him. And he induced him, the Revised Standard Version, to go up against Ramoth Gilead. Now let's take a look at where this is, because this is an important part of Jehoshaphat's life. We are introduced to a scene here in Samaria, where Jehoshaphat goes down to Samaria here, and he's being persuaded by King Ahab to go against Ramoth Gilead, a city of refuge over here that had been taken by Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. Now, practically speaking, the venture appears to have no purpose whatsoever for Jehoshaphat. What does he have to gain by taking Ramoth Gilead, which is adjacent to Israel? So that politically it has very, very little to offer him. And yet, you can imagine this king. He's sitting with a million men in his armor. And he's built fortresses, and he's got store cities, and he's set up commanders over all of his army. And he goes down to Samaria. And there's King Ahab, and with all the fanfare, he kills oxen and sheep and so on for him. And Jehoshaphat is taken in, brothers and sisters. A man who was courageous in the ways of the Lord, we read about him. The man who sent out his princes and the Levites and the priests to teach all through the kingdom. And where is he now? He's down in Samaria. And there you can see, brothers and sisters, the subtle character of sin. Just like that lion couching at the door, its desire is for you, but you must master it. And what's Jehoshaphat going to do now? Well, he says to Ahab, he says, I am as you are. Why, my horses are as your horses in the king's account. My people are as your people, and we will go with you to the war. So Jehoshaphat is compromised. What affinity was there really between the house of Ahab and the spiritual climate developed by Asa and fostered by Jehoshaphat? It was like night and day. There was no affinity. Yet Jehoshaphat had not learned the principle of separation in the people of God. Oh, he did it physically in sealing the border. But what good was that when you had a marriage alliance? And when now you're going to embark upon a military career with this wicked king? Now, Jehoshaphat, the man of God, percolates through him. It's very interesting to see where there's almost, in the King Jehoshaphat, the conscience of the man of God keeps coming back to him. But the environment is taking him in. He said, don't you think that we should first inquire for the word of the Lord? He's a godly man. As for Ahab, he's a single-minded sinner. There's no problem for Ahab. He's got the 400 false prophets of Jezebel for his counselors. Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, 400 of them. And they must have had the peculiar attire of Jezebel's friends, and said to them, shall we go to battle against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I forbear?
And they said, well, go up, for God will give it into the hand of the king. Now, Jehoshaphat seems just a little ill at ease here. And he says, is there not another prophet of the Lord whom we may inquire? Jehoshaphat must have known full well these weren't prophets of the Lord. That was all of the apostasy existing in the north. Well, yes, said Ahab, there really is one more, but I don't have any use for him because he's Micaiah, the son of Imlah, and every time he prophesies evil against me. That's the story of really Ahab's life. I found you, said Ahab to Elijah, as if, you know, Ahab's the poor, innocent person being victimized by these prophets in the land. Anyway, we have here Jehoshaphat slightly reproving the king. Oh, let this man have his say. Let Micaiah say what he's going to say. And so here's the picture that we have, brothers and sisters. If we take a look at the circumstances now, outside the gate, or by the gate of Samaria, we have here, if we can try to recapture all of the drama of what's taking place here, we have Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and the people who are with him. And remember, they've been really induced or persuaded because of all the fanfare, great riches and honor, and the whole circumstance has made for Jehoshaphat here seeking alliance and oneness with Ahab, king of Israel. And they find this prophet Micaiah, in contrast to the 400 prophets of Jezebel and Ahab, and Zedekiah, who represents and is the spokesman of the 400. Now, the king of Israel and Judah, the king of Judah, and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting on their thrones. This is really a great event. And they are arrayed in their robes. And they're sitting at the threshing floor, this open or void place, at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets were prophesying before them. And then a very graphic scene takes place. And Zedekiah, the son of Kenaanah, made for himself horns of iron and said, thus the Lord says, with these you shall push the Syrians until they are destroyed. And all the 400 prophets say, go up to Ramoth Gilead and triumph, and the Lord will give it into the hand of the king. Now, brothers and sisters, there's one man, like Caleb and like Samson, who stands out here. It's not Jehoshaphat. You see sin, king sin, taking over and dominating this man until his conscience becomes seared. And here's Micaiah, and a messenger sent to summon Micaiah. Behold, the words of the prophets with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your word be like the word of one of them and speak favorably. And Micaiah says, as Yahweh lives, what my God says, that will I speak. And when he had come to the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? Now, this is an ironical speech on the part of Micaiah. And he answered, go on up and triumph. Go on up and prosper. They'll be given into your hand. Ahab recognized that wasn't the intent of the prophecy of this man. He says, how many times shall I adjure you that you speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? As if King Ahab were interested in truth. And so Micaiah says, I saw all Israel scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each return to his home in peace. And how tragically true. Where was the shepherd in Israel? It wasn't Ahab, and it sure wasn't Jehoshaphat at this time. And there were the sheep left without no shepherd, and they were going to be scattered upon the mountains. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, didn't I tell you he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? And Micaiah then proceeds to give an indicting parable. And he depicts an evil spirit coming forth and entering the prophets of King Ahab. Now, therefore, in verse 22, therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of these your prophets. Yahweh has spoken evil concerning you. So what he depicted here, very graphically, was a picture in which an evil spirit would come from Yahweh and would go down and enter the mouths of all these 400 prophets, and they would speak what they spoke. Then Zedekiah, the son of Kenaanah, the leader of the 400 false prophets, came near, and he smote him on the cheek, Micaiah, and said, "Well, which way did the Spirit of the Lord go from me to you to speak?" In other words, he's trying irony the same way as Micaiah was using on the 400 false prophets and King Ahab. And Micaiah said, "You shall see on that day when you go into an inner chamber to hide yourself." Because when they were defeated in battle, and when the sons died in the battle, the fathers would go looking for this man, Zedekiah, who prophesied victory, when in fact defeat was the order of the day. And then the king of Israel said, "Seize Micaiah and take him back to Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son. And say, thus saith the king, put this fellow in prison and feed him with fat scare of bread and water until I return in peace." Now, where's Jehoshaphat? Where's his voice? Here's the man who's courageous in the ways of the Lord, and he's standing there induced by all the fanfare of King Ahab at Micaiah's expense. He knew what Micaiah was saying. He knew Micaiah was a prophet of Yahweh, and he stands there and he allows that prophet to be sent to prison and to be fed with scant fare of bread and water, in contrast for him, where they killed sheep and oxen in abundance for him. Brothers and sisters, sin supplies its own anesthetic. And you can see the decline of King Jehoshaphat here. And you see how the slide's almost inevitable now. And Micaiah says to King Ahab, "If you return in peace, the Lord has not spoken by me." And he said, "Hear all ye people." There was the testimony. There was the vindication of Micaiah. There's my prophecy. And then we have the attempted disguise. And so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "I think I'll disguise myself. You can have all the glory of this battle, Jehoshaphat. You wear the royal robes and lead the battle." And of course, Jehoshaphat, with his million men all bristling there, all ready to fight, he's mustered a huge army. Why, he was glad to take the battle. He was glad to march into battle. But the king of Israel, of course, he already knew the words of Elijah the prophet, that the dogs would lick his blood where they licked the blood of Naboth. He said, "I think I'll disguise myself. You take the glory of this battle, King Jehoshaphat, and I'll just be like any other Israelite. They won't just know for sure who I am." And the king of Israel, the king of Syria, had commanded the captain of the chariots, "Fight with neither small nor great, but only with the king of Israel." And when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, they said, "It's the king of Israel." So they turned to fight against him, and Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him. Glorious words. There's the prodigal son, brothers and sisters, who came to himself. The Lord helped him. Humanly speaking, Jehoshaphat was as good as a dead man. Apparently, the Syrians had flanked the advance of the Israelis, and they'd moved in to get the king. Who was going to protect Jehoshaphat now? Where was his army of a million men? Where was Ahab with all his army? And we can see here that the Lord remembered Jehoshaphat for good, like he did Nehemiah, like he did with Samson, and like he did with Caleb. And we read here that God drew them away from him, or he allured them away. For when the captains of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. The mercy of God. And Jehoshaphat here was bereft of everything he had striven for. Of what use were his fortified cities? His much business in Jerusalem? He was about to perish. And yet the Almighty, in his kindness and grace extended toward him, spared his life. But for King Ahab, the man who tries to hide himself from the Almighty, a certain man drew his bow at a venture in his simplicity.
And he struck the king of Israel between the scale armor and the breastplate. And therefore he said to the driver of his chariot, "Turn about and carry me out of the battle, for I am sore wounded." And the battle grew hot that day. And the king of Israel propped himself up in his chariot facing the Syrians until evening. Then at sunset, he died. You see, the man who did not recognize that all things are naked and open before him with whom we had to do, tried, so to speak, to fool the Almighty. And obviously it didn't work. Now, though King Ahab was no coward when it came to battle, he stuck in there, propped up in his chariot, in the heat of the day, until the sunset. Can you imagine the thoughts that must have went through his mind? You think of Naboth, you think of Micaiah, you think of Elijah, you think of what these prophets had said to him, and he died. And brothers and sisters, the difference between Ahab and Jehoshaphat is the difference between a man, Ahab, politically expedient, but brothers and sisters, a full-time sinner. And Jehoshaphat, who's a man, like unto David, he set his heart to seek the Almighty, although he had flaws in his character. And the great lesson of King Jehoshaphat, brothers and sisters, is that we might well be tempted in our period of despair. But let us not think, brothers and sisters, that we cannot be tempted in our very great prosperity and our seemingly successes. Because the very success of Jehoshaphat in the early part of his reign contained within it the seeds of trial. Now we see what happens with Jehoshaphat. Because Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him. And he said to the king, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord?" And I'm sure Jehoshaphat must have thought of what happened with Asa and Hanani. How his dad, in a rage, threw the prophet in the stocks and put him in prison. But not Jehoshaphat. He had the moldable heart, the kind of person that could be touched by the Almighty and benefit from trial. We read, "Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out among his people from Beersheba to the hill country of Ephraim, and he brought them back to the Lord, the God of their fathers. And he appointed judges in the land and all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city," and so on. A man who corrected the wayward influence of his life and got his priorities straight at this time, and set about the spiritual reformation of the nation. Brothers and sisters, a great lesson for us in the lives of these kings of Israel and Judah. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you.